The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, ELN leads enterprise networks, or something like that. Mark makes his mark on disks. Joe's picking up bad vibrations. And they're giving him new sensations, more fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The influence operations surrounding the Middle East are accelerating quickly, and along with them, the violence against innocent people. The media is in too much of a rush to judgment and is making big mistakes, fueling the fires of hatred and violence. Stop, think, act. It's good for Scuba, and it's good for you. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel to exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events and help host online forums, panels, and events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. For more details, become a member at enterprisemindset.com.
ELN will have a forum at the Monterey Plaza Hotel on November 13th and 14th of this year. To sign up, go to thecybershow.co and click on the link to ELN. This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. Mark Menz was one of the early folks in digital forensics, working for law enforcement and for the public well-being, as well as on many private cases. Early in my forensics career, I encountered Mark, and I thought you'd be interested in some of the things that we've done throughout the course of our lives and some of the discussions we've had. Here's Mark.
Tell me about the National Criminal Justice Lab, how you got involved, and what you ended up doing there.
So I had known about them before because my brother was interfacing with them, and I had interfaced with them as well to provide some training, helping write training for doing forensics.
When you say interfaced with them, all right, you're not a computer.
Oh, okay. So they would call, your mentor would call me to help, ask some questions to help write.
Right. Sorry, my mentor?
Oh, yes. Bill Sperno.
So I have to tell you, he was never, as far as I was aware, my mentor, but
I had to say that because he had to strike back at you now that he has passed. So he has come back.
So I probably only met him a few times. That was in the context of Tom Johnson and like that.
Yeah. No, but anyway, Bill would call me occasionally to help write classes for the lab, which is, they provided training across the country on cyber investigations and cyber forensics. Computer forensics.
Yeah, it wasn't called cyber at the time.
Correct. It was just called computer forensics. And the National Criminal Justice Lab is also called CERCH, which is a consortium of all 50 states. And they paid for this organization to exist, which was a non-governmental organization, but was only doing stuff for the government. So,
okay. Now, at CERCH, you had a facility up in Sacramento there, right?
Yes, we had a training facility, and we had labs that we did work in. We would do classes, and then we would also work on projects for people who needed help, various law enforcement agencies and other organizations in law enforcement.
They would just sort of call you up and say, can you help? And you'd say, sure.
Yeah. And then we go down, image drives, do forensics on it, write a report.
All right. So people don't know what all that stuff means. So image drive, what's that?
So we would take a hard drive and we would make a copy of all user accessible data objects, basically copy the drive from one drive to another. So we would copy.
All the bits, right?
All
when
the bits.
When you say all the user whatever objects, data objects, you mean the sequence of bits written on the disk.
Correct. The sequence
it's actually more complicated than that, right?
It is. The simple way to look at it is, you know, we'd make a copy of all the bits. So that one drive is now, the end product is a replication of that first drive. It's an exact copy.
Exact
copy with quotes, right?
It operates in the same manner. That is, if you plugged it in, everything would be in the same place, and as if it was, well, not as if it was written in the same sequence necessarily.
Correct.
But because it isn't, it's written in a different sequence than the original, even though the location of all the bits is the same.
And what it is we say user accessible data objects, because it's what's presented to the user is the same, but the actual locations will be different.
That's because the drives remap locations, right? It's the physicality of the drives. Because, for example, of error correction and so forth, the physicality of the drives is different than the logical external appearance at the interface.
Right. So what you're concerned with is the logical information, because that's what you're basing everything on.
Well, you might be concerned with that, but normally that's what you're concerned about in digital forensics. But there are situations where that's sort of not quite right, right?
Correct. I would say at 95 to 98%, it's logical. Then we have that small percentage where the physical actually has meanings.
You mean like where the bits turn from ones to zeros because the disks get old and mangled, right?
Correct. Correct.
All right. So that's disk imaging. That's the first thing you said. Okay. Right. What else did you do besides disk imaging?
Disk imaging, then we'd also teach them how to do forensics and use tools.
Yeah. Now, when you say forensics, right, there's some debate in the field about what that is.
It used to mean back then the ability to recover deleted information or information that was not readily accessible by the user. And logs and deleted logs or items that were in space where it existed, you could get it originally, but now it exists in a space that you have to do something special in order to pull it out.
Yeah, so the area after the end of the file, before the end of the block on the disk, for example, right?
Right. Any unallocated space that was allocated before.
Or space that was that's no longer accessible because it's breaking down, right?
Correct.
Because the controller said it's not there anymore. And, of course, once the companies that made these disks started to decide that they wanted to sell bigger disks for more money, they would take the same disk and modify the interface so that it said it was smaller than it really was, right?
Correct, because they could make the big one all day long, low price, and then they need to have differentiation for different pricing on stuff.
Yeah.
Other thing was the interpretation of logs and of files to look at the string of bits and be able to understand what it means. like the MFT record, the master file table on our current Windows operating system, has a lot of information in there that can be very valuable for certain types of cases and matters. Beyond timing dates and the name of the file.
Yeah, other things, you know, protections, who wrote it, when it was written, the sequence, all sorts of things might be in there.
Correct. And we've had some cases where that became, it becomes extremely important.
Yeah, and then there are other cases where people intentionally modify the content on the disk in a manner that's not consistent with the normal operation of the operating system so as to make it so you can't see it in normal use, but it's actually there. So they use that to hide things not at the level that the operating system understands, right?
Correct. I've had a case where we had somebody would backdate documents. But if you look at where the file was inside the master file table, it doesn't match where it would be if it was written at that time.
Yeah. Now, this comes to another issue that I think is very important. The stuff people do to get around your attempts to do forensics. That is, and I'll use a different definition than yours. I'll say it's something for presentation in a legal matter. Right?
Okay.
That is, and that's really what we're focused on. There's another field that they call forensics that's really investigations, you know, corporate investigations and so forth. But the sort of the real stuff is testimony in court. Is that basically right?
Yes, absolutely. However, I'll bring this up now because it's important, is when you're looking at something being investigative or an analysis of something, it's important because the two fields, especially when you're looking at doing it, you have to be careful of laws that are written. So a investigation is when you're looking for the stacks of hay out in the field. The analysis is when you've got someone identified that stack of hay, and now you're going through looking for the needles.
And well, there are different characterizations, but I'm not familiar with that as a technical explanation. But the truth is, when you go to present things in court, those kinds of explanations work better probably than the ones that I give.
Yeah. Well, that one comes from the post training for investigators. So they understand.
Oh, nobody tell us about post because they don't know what post is.
Oh, sorry. Peace officers, standards, and training.
Okay. And it turns out at some point, because I worked with you guys, I was a post-certified forensic examiner.
Absolutely.
What the heck does that mean?
One of the few civilians, there's only six of us that are certified computer crime investigators, and you are one of those.
Am I still, or was I once?
You still are. It doesn't go away. Once you have it, you got it.
Is that right? Well, fantastic. Okay. Now, see, I've been claiming this, you know, on all of my reports for legal matters, and I said I was a post-certified, but now I know I'm still am. So until the day I die, I will be certified as one of the six civilians. Wow, that's right. Amazing. Who are the other five?
Myself, my brother. Oh, well, he was law enforcement, so he doesn't count. Myself, Fred was law enforcement. Todd Colvin. And I'll have to look at the other ones. I don't remember the names off the top of my head.
There you go. I had no idea. Wow. All right. So you're running this training center. I wanted to talk just a little bit about what a typical forensic lab looks like. You know, so it's not what they show on TV, right?
I wish it was.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh. Bones. If I could have a lab like Bones has, that would have been awesome.
So. Okay. But what does a typical forensics lab, either a private or even one that's for law enforcement, for digital forensics, what did it look like in that time frame?
That time, he had a lockable room for physical security with controlled access, meaning not just anyone could go in there. You'd have to have a...
Yeah, so it had a lock.
It had a lock, and you had... some people would keep logs of who went in and who went out.
Yeah, as if it was an evidence room, but...
Right. And then the evidence room was separate. That's where you store evidence. And so you do keep a track of who goes in and goes out and what comes in and what goes out and who with. And in this computer lab room, you would have a one or more computers that you have set up. And you would have the a forensic, you know, an operating system on them that runs them, and then you would have forensic software that would be running on them.
All right, so let's just go a little bit backwards here. So typical size of one of these rooms where you have all these disks stored, what's this, is it 100 feet by 100 feet? What's the typical size of one of those storage rooms?
A storage room for evidence would typically be back then probably 20 by 60.
20 feet by 60 feet?
Yeah, about 1,000 square feet.
Wow. So my experience was a closet.
Yeah. Well, in mine, I had a lab here. My storage space was 4 by 8. So.
Yeah, oh, that's a big one. Yeah.
Big closet.
I mean, I went to some national forensic places in various countries around the world in the course of my career. And it's not unusual to have something that's 4 foot by 4 foot, you know, with a door that has a lock on it, you know, a key lock. And that's it.
Absolutely. In fact,
and they're piled up, right? All these disks are like piled up in stacks with a paper label attached to them, right?
Yep. And I've actually, a major agency in California, when they sent me to go down to get the disks from where they locked them up at, it was literally a box about a box the size of a suitcase that was underneath the water heater in the basement.
Yeah, well, just in case you wanted to, if there was a fire, you wouldn't have to worry there'd be water all over them. And
right.
No problem. They might rust, but that's not their problem. All right. So this is the typical forensic lab. And then for computers, you know, you have a couple computers there. Now, in the facility that you had up in Sacramento, you had a big room. You had a training room that, you know, it had probably 50 people could sit in there and train on computers simultaneously, right?
Yes. We had it set up for 20 up to 25 on computers. And that was the training lab. And then we had our individual labs. Like I had a room that was 8 by 20, 160 square feet. And half was my lab with a, you know, desk and chair and the computers. The other third would be the my desk that was like an office.
Yeah. And when you handle these things, it's not like a clean room atmosphere, right? It's more like a dirty room, right?
Yeah, it's a dirty room atmosphere. Because you were just handling drives and you weren't worrying about fingerprints or material that was on them or what have you. Yep. That was all done, if it had to be done, by whoever seized it.
Yeah. And then there's dust and dirt and oil and all sorts of stuff. And then you set these disks on your desk and you plug stuff into them, you know, just some hairy cable that you plug into it. And if you screw it up, then you write onto a disk instead of reading from it, right?
Back in the very beginning, yes.
So, Chris, what do you think of digital forensics? Not what it is on TV, right?
Very little is, eh? Right. Here. What's interesting is what is. You know. Shout out to Mark Rogers, who is among the folks, the key person to keep Mr. Robot fairly accurate as a TV as content out there for cybersecurity. But no, it's all very complicated and boring, right? Or really exciting if you're into that, but it doesn't always make great TV.
It's just the I'm totally astonished by the notion that somehow I'm one of the 5 or 6 civilians that are somehow now post-certified. I had no idea. It seems like it's the nature of things that.
Again, it comes up so often in these. You know, shows like this and these conversations amongst us, you know, the various where you and I cross paths and frankly the rest of my time. And a bunch of us walk around going, I don't know how I got here. Seriously. You know, Pablo Brouwer always comes to mind when I say this. And here's a guy who ran, information warfare effectively for the U.S. Special Services for 25 years, right? Amazing background, amazing guy, right? I remember him saying that, you know, forget where we were, but yeah, it's fascinating that we get to carry this path and see all these things. And it is as exciting as the movies, just not in a different way, right? You know, you're going to package it in 30 minutes. Sure. You know, somebody's going to wiggle their fingers and get a password or something. They'll look at a hard drive with their X-ray vision and get the lost data. But it's so fascinating.
So how long does it take, do you think, to image like a 4 terabyte hard drive?
And of course, all depends on when you're doing it, right? You know, 20 years from now, no time at all. 20 years ago, yeah.
But say now, how long you figure it takes now?
I honestly have no idea, right? I'd have to ask my son, you know, what are bus feeds and like these days? You know, and to follow any of these things, right? You know, the supply chain security thing I'm working on, the U.S. Army has a request for information now, you know, that I've been putting in some thoughts into today. And it's fascinating as we look at where we are and where we're going, right? And you know, digital forensics, you know, is a good, you know, maybe I'm just thinking about supply chain a lot. But how do you put it all together? You know, okay, how long does it take this, you know, image a terabyte? You know, how long does it take to image 1,000 of those? Right, because that's where we're going, right? And if anything doesn't extend into the lots of more zeros, we got a new way coming.
Well, this reminds me of, I don't know if you're aware of the technology that was used to reproduce floppy disks back in the days when there were floppy disks that were being sold at, you know, at retail and so forth. Or the CD-ROM production process and so forth. But the floppy disk production process for lots and lots of places consisted of, you know, 20 or 30, however many computers, each with two floppy disk drives, one of them to read the source and the other one to write the destination. And I've seen places where people just walked around the room pulling out the destination floppy when it was done, putting in a new one, pushing, you know, enter to do it again, and then sticking a label on the floppy disk and, you know, putting it into a sleeve and then putting that into a box and closing up the box. I mean, that's how it was, right?
Well, you know, you look for repeating processes, right? And every time we go through, you know, the beginning stage of something emergent, you know, we do things one way, and then later on we do it another. You know, it's like the disk icon, that little square icon we're all familiar with. You know, speaking of floppies, we don't actually have those anymore, but we have this thing in our head. And you know, so with software bill of materials right now, right? You know, so software bill of materials is the contents of what's in your software. And if you didn't know this, surprise, inside your software is more software, right? Libraries and links and all sorts of things. Whoever made your software didn't write all of it by any long shot. They included all sorts of stuff that already existed. And figuring out how you nest all that stuff together is kind of fascinating. It's a big deal in the world these days. But mostly the leading vendors in this space today will have a portal. If you're one of their right kind of customers, they'll give you a portal. You can go there and, you know, like you're saying, Fred, you know, you can pull the floppy out, you can download the file, say, I've got the SBOM, yay, and you can put it in another floppy drive. But 10 years from now, or three, you're not doing that anymore. Yeah, that's like walking across the room and pulling the floppy drive, because, no, what are you going to do with 100,000 of them, you know, a day, or on Wednesday, or whatever, right? But it's the same thing. Still, you just automate the pulling the floppy out and walking across the room, right? And it, you know, written by some guy in Kansas, you know, as an open source library that's included in everybody else's code.
Which brings me to, I'd like to stay on the topic of forensics, but I have difficulty doing it. And the reason is, you know, I'm in the process of the eternal repair of my computer system, which for some reason went through an upgrade, and the upgrade, of course, made it so nothing works anymore. So,
as one does.
So these forensic skills that I have both enable me to be able to do this kind of stuff, but also make me so dangerous to myself. You know, so when you're doing this with evidence, you know, you tend to be very careful, right? It's just like, wait a minute, is this the right, you know, drive? Because like, if you're copying from one thing to another, you know, you better, if you copy from the destination disk to the source disk, and then all of a sudden the source of the forensic information is overwritten with, I guess, what was on those floppy disks that he talked about hit with a baseball. So you get nothing. You destroy the evidence. But when you do it, you know, for systems administration, especially when you have lots of these systems, the automation just does not cut it, right? It will not recover your system to where it should be. Which brings us to backups and recovery.
Yeah.
Are you aware of any backup technology that actually does, you know, what you would like for a backup? That is to say, have a proper history of what took place, and then also allow you to recover it?
in short, no, right? You know, but this, it raises an interesting, you know, timely topic to my head, and that's cloud OT. You know, remember you and I did that 25-year plan for the Colombian grid, and you know, 7 years, 15 years, 25 years, and part of it was cloud OT. And I arranged a meeting between one of the big global cloud providers in Medellin and the leadership of the national grid down there. And it was one of the funniest things. This is about four or five years ago now, right? But my premise was, you're going to have to do this. At some point in the future, you're going to take all these physical devices that you'd relied on for the last 30, 40 years and, quote unquote, put them in the cloud, because the economics will force it, right? You just, the benefits, cost benefits can be so huge that despite all the problems, you're going to do it. And, you know, it was a radical thing to say at the time. This year, this calendar year,
it's still a radical thing, if you ask, and we've been talking to Joe Weiss about this, so, you know.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, Joe, but, you know, but, you know, this, in my experience, this year is the year that that's changed. You know, anybody except Joe will agree. We're here now, you know, the OT's in the cloud already, right? You need to figure it out, right? You know, what problems does that bring? What advantages, what compensating controls you put in place? Because the sheer economics of it, you know, that's, you know, one of the most striking things for me in that whole exercise you and I did in Colombia was, you know, running some numbers and just looking at the way we do things now and saying we're going to do those for the next 25 years, or we're going to do things the way I think they're going to go, which is this sort of thing, cloud OT and so forth. And the difference is you can have the first world infrastructure and afford it in given the economics of that nation, or you can spend the entire GDP of the country to do it the old way for the next 25 years. And you just can't get there from here, right? Anyways, right? You know, so the fact that we're, you know, while it's true, we have no backup worth a hill of beans, where you can really just take your personal computer and have it come back the way it was supposed to, much less something in a critical situation. However, we can have images of OT devices, of programmable logic controllers and so forth. They're stored off-site, in somebody on somebody else's computer, or maybe yours if you're big enough or whatever, somewhere else, and make resilient, redundant systems, you know, that will cope with that.
Right. So getting back to forensics, which I like to do when I'm talking to people talking about forensics. So that now you have lots and lots of copies, right? And the lots and lots of copies bring some really good positive things for forensics and some really bad negative things for forensics. And so, you know, one of the positives is, I need to find something. Well, you know what? There are 1,000 copies out there.
Yes, and some are on a distributed ledger or otherwise have a really high integrity, and you can really count on those. Or they all look alike except for this one. You know, that's pretty easy to tell.
Right. Which brings us to part two. Thank you. So, two problems. One of them is all those copies might be different from each other. Because, you know, when you're doing especially a backup of a live system, and they now, you know, there's a lot of live forensics these days. So they're doing for, you know, trying to make an image, a bit for bit copy of a live system. Well, the system is changing. So your so-called exact copy, you know, it has, you know, this many bits from this millisecond, and the rest, you know, the next set of bits are from the next millisecond and so forth. So it's like taking a horizontal slice. You know how NTSC video scans, right? So imagine you're looking at a movie and you're scanning the first line, and then you're on the next frame and you scan the next line, and you're on the next frame and you scan the next line. Well, guess what? When you put it all together, it doesn't look like any picture that was ever on the movie. So, you know, then you're going to go into court and say, no, this is really what it was. Well, no, this is what this part of it was now and that part of it was then and so forth. So there are all sorts of challenges in doing this live stuff. And that's partly the problem we have in backups, right? Especially associated with live systems, right? So you talk about an industrial control system. You know, these things, the content, the bits are changing all the time because they're controlling real-time processes. So, you know, whatever was true a millisecond ago is not true anymore.
Right. It's a brain, you know, like you say, we'll try to stick to forensics, right? You know, so if I'm focusing on forensics and this is the universe that I'm moving into, this is the universe I'm moving into, and I focus on forensics.
right? You know, so and it's there are upsides to it, right? You know, the reality of the world is that that's the way everything is. You know, you can cast an iron bar, but the, you know, inside that, the atoms are moving around. You leave it all by itself in a perfect, you know, it will change over time. Everything does. So the idea that we could take a snapshot of something as dynamic as a computer system, much less, you know, an entire network, cybernetic, you know, what we have now, much less where we're going, is kind of silly on the face of it. So well, what can you get? What's left is really the question.
Well, what's a reliable and authentic record, right? What's an accurate reflection of what took place for the purposes of testifying in court about a legal matter that could make the difference about whether somebody ends up in jail for the rest of their life, or in some cases being put to death, or, you know, losing their fortune or the work that they spent their whole life, you know, gathering and yeah.
What is operationally, you know, let me just, you know, freelance on this one, but I'm running a big chunk of electric grid. And I've got tens of thousands of devices, and you know, they fall into various classes, and I want to take snapshots of them at a certain frequency and put those someplace with high in integrity, so I'd all get, you know, something of high fidelity back, you know, most likely exactly what it was. And I'll get enough samples, you know, that I can compare them, look for anomalies and so forth. Right? That's the kind of thing, right? It's not, as you just said, you know, at every microsecond, I take a full image of every device and I put those where? No, we're not going to do that. That's just not realistic. But, you know, once a day, once an hour, once a minute, I don't know. You know, depends what you're building and how critical it is.
But, well, and the question is its use, right? And this is sort of a fundamental, right? So you're putting out, you know, boats, you know, tens, hundreds, maybe thousands or more boats you'll have out there, each with tens, hundreds, thousands of sensors. And each one of them is a different location on the ocean. Of course, you know, the nature of time is that, you know, if you're a millimeter away, the time is different, right? Because time only transits at the speed of light, right? So there is no such thing as the same time. So it's only within the bounds of the precision and accuracy of the measurement you're trying to make for the purpose you're trying to make it for. So right. These that are sensing the situation on the ocean and under the ocean and looking for pollution and looking for changes, you know, you might be able to detect a storm coming by the changes in the motion of the ocean and so forth. You know, all of these sensors, it's all a function of the purpose. So the forensic purpose is generally, you know, it's good enough to demonstrate to the standard of admissibility of the evidence. And the standard of admissibility, generally speaking, for evidence in the United States and most similar nations, is that it's more probative than prejudicial. And so what that means is it probative means it's informative towards understanding the issues in the matter, trying to get at the facts. Prejudicial means that it causes you to believe one way or another about those facts. So the concept is that everything is prejudicial. Anything, you know, if I say the sky is blue and you look at the sky and it looks gray to you, you know, you say, well, that guy's probably not credible, right? So that's prejudicial. Probative, it has to be more informative. So, well, the sky is blue. When I say blue, I mean this wavelength, you know, the blah, blah, blah. Then, you know, maybe if that wavelength is the critical, you know, factor in this particular determination, that's more probative than prejudicial. So,
well, I think about this, right? You know, so pros and cons, you know, the way we're doing forensics now is we find stuff laying around, right? Because as we discussed earlier, you know, an actual backup is a rare and wonderful thing, you know, may not exist, who knows. So all the forensics we've done to date, all the digital forensics is finding things laying around and being able to figure out what's on them. And I'm going to read, you know, in the U.S. Army request for information on SBOM management, public information, it's out there on the web, as a question, how do you envision the requirements of software bill of materials impacting collaboration and communication with your suppliers, partners, and customers? It's a fascinating question, right? And it's, you know, I could, you know, tell them something about forensics, right? By actually establishing regular communications and looking at the artifacts you want to get from your supply chain and making sure you have them and they're the right quality and that they're maintained at the right fidelity and so forth will make, you know, your collaboration better, faster, cheaper, right? Because right now you're hunting through everywhere to find that information, and to the point of forensics, when something terrible happens, you know, it's even worse. right? You know, so that's not good for collaboration with your partners. It's just a waste of time, and it, you know, causes a lot of social conflict, and people don't want to work together. So I think, you know, it, you know, forensics will be so much easier once we've established actual ways to record the information we actually care about personally, as a company, you know, as an organization, with our supply chain partners, whatever it is. Because the way we do it right now is like so many other things ad hoc.
Well, so it turns out there is a field that has emerged in the last few years in forensics that's about not doing that, right? It's about forensic preparation, you know, being ready to and producing on a regular basis the forensic information you're going to need for whatever the purpose that you anticipate is. Having said that, I wish today there was, you know, SBOM had the capacity to say, here's a piece of software giving me a problem on my computer. Can you tell me which libraries are incompatible? You know, what, because what's happening here over time as a particular, any individual system evolves, is it gets different components pushed in with the software update methodology. And the update methodology is basically changing from underneath other software, the mechanisms, the functions, the program codes that it's using to do things. And when those things change underneath you, the system starts not functioning properly. So you need a consistent set of things with all the necessary libraries. And previously we were talking about containerization and these containers. So the current world out there has and uses containers increasingly. And these containers are called snapshots, and they're stored so that when you load a piece of software, it includes with it a set of libraries and other things that go with that version of the software. You're supposed to be able to drop it into a system, and it doesn't have to worry about the rest of the environment being right. However, what we find is that the containers make things worse, at least for now, because the containers assume other things. And because we're no longer tracking the interdependencies, we assume the container has it. When the rest of the system changes, the container is assuming interdependencies that no longer exist. And now you have behavior that's even less traceable because the containers are so-called self-enclosed, which means that they're doing things like encrypting the content and so forth and optimizing it internally so you don't have to look inside it. But if you can't look inside it, you can't tell how it's misinteracting with what's outside of it. Which brings us to logs. So logs are a big part of forensics. In forensics, you know, you have these audit trails of things that took place. And the audit trail should be consistent with what you find when you look at the rest of the system. And this is where you run into inconsistencies. But I don't want to get ahead of us.
We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co. We're having discussions with Joe Weiss. Joe is an old school control systems guy who worked on control systems for the first half of his career and ended up in cybersecurity by accident, as usual.
Welcome back, Joe. Last time we were talking about inherently safe systems and so forth, but we're still walking through the history. So you worked at GE in nuclear plants. So how long did you work at GE and what else did you do there?
I was there about 10 years, and one of the more interesting projects, and this is what literally led me to the path I'm on today, was, as you were saying, in a nuclear plant, a fission plant, not a fusion plant, but a fission plant that depends on neutrons colliding with other neutrons, they split and release energy. To do that in what's called the light water reactor, you need to slow those neutrons down so they can hit each other, okay?
All right, so hang on. What when you say light water, we think of water as H2O, and it has a specific weight associated with the fact that it's H2O. It's however many molecules per mole, and they have a mass, right, and that gives you the weight. So what makes it light water?
Because I'll give you the other angle. What the Canadians sell is what's called a heavy water reactor, which isn't H2O, it's H3O. In other words, it's heavy hydrogen, okay?
Oh, so there's an extra hydrogen atom on every molecule.
Yes.
So it's no longer the water we drink, it's heavy water, okay.
Yeah.
So
now, and
so
by the
light,
way,
is light water H2O or is light water H1O or something?
No, light water is your standard H2O. Okay. If you think about during World War II and in Norway and whatever, that was all because of the heavy water. Okay. That was theoretically going to make a reaction easier. Okay.
Yeah. Or the other thing about the heavy water that was important in World War II is it was not that easy to make.
Correct.
And so the U.S. ended up ahead of Germany in making it, which is one of the reasons we could launch our bombs and they could not.
Yeah. So all of these things, and by the way, that also has led to some of the if you will, public relations problems we have with nuclear today, is it's viewed as having coming out of the bomb or weapons program.
Yeah. All right. We're going to talk about that separately because that's a subject that's a particular sore point between my father and the father of another person of my generation in that nuclear field. But I want to stay away from that for the moment and stay in the cyber arena. So, yes. So the jobs that you had.
One of the jobs.
Got you into this arena.
Okay. And that's why I was starting with this discussion of light water and moderation.
Yeah, it's just that when you talk about light or heavy water, people aren't used to that. You got to.
Right. So if you will, call it standard water. Your normal water reactor. What GE had is to monitor the power in the reactor. They had this 10 to 12 foot long stainless steel tube that had a sensor that would go traverse up and down that tube. And what would happen is these tubes set between the fuel bundles, which were made of zirconium, and zirconium is lighter than stainless steel. Well, the more water you have that was going by those thermal neutron detectors, the better the signal would be. In other words, the more you slow the neutrons down, the more collisions and the more power you'd be able to measure.
Yeah, okay, so you could detect how fast things were moving by the sensor.
Yeah, well, no, the sensors are going to detect the power. This is the power going on.
Oh, but it's an indirect measurement of the speed of the neutrons.
Yeah, well, correct, in a sense. You're really not measuring speed. You're really measuring, if you will, collisions, okay?
All right, but it's still an indirect measurement of speed because slower means more collisions, more collisions means more.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So it turns out that with this particular vintage of plants, they originally had a bunch of holes down in the bottom of the core for water to flow through. And they did some testing. And the testing showed that when this extra water flowed through, it caused this 10 to 12 foot long, 1 inch in diameter tube to vibrate.
Okay. And that caused what?
Well, the thought was, even though they saw it, they're going, how much damage could this 1 inch tube in this gap that was maybe an inch total around, how much damage could it do? And they're going, well, you know, gee, we saw it touch here or there. What harm could it do?
Okay. Well, so the answer comes in a slide rule, right?
No, the answer actually came through when the Fukushima 2 nuclear plant in Japan. Now, again, we're talking, this is in the 70s.
Yeah. So how much damage it can do?
Well, that's the answer. What we found was, lo and behold, it caused a 54 square inch hole in the fuel bundles. Not trivial. So my job.
Yeah, 54 inches is, that's almost like 5 feet, right? That's 4.5 feet.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this was non-trivial. So I'm doing all of this analysis of, you know, the instrument tubes, you know, trying to figure out what the power distribution is and what's going on. Because all of this is fed into the different calculations for not only power, but for safety and for lifetime of the fuel, da-da-da-da-da. Okay, so this is feeding all kinds of calculations. Well, the first thing we were trying to figure out is what happened. And what we realized was it was that extra water flowing in that was causing the tubes to vibrate. So the first thing we did is, again, from the test facility, we found out what the natural frequency was of that instrument tube.
Of course, because the frequency of the vibrations, it gets positive feedback if you get to the natural frequency, just like an antenna.
Yes. Okay. So what was going on was that just like in a lot of different vibration cases, if you find that you're near the natural frequency, you want to do something. Normally, it's putting in some type of structural support or something to be
By the way, we got another alert. There we go.
Okay, I haven't gotten my other alert yet, but anyways.
One of two, and then I got the Spanish. All right, well, you'll get yours soon.
Sure I will.
All right, so there's only, you know, this is like the whatever Tacoma Bridge, right? The famous movie.
That's exactly. Remember, so the whole point is, this is the mechanical engineering 101 thing. So what you want to do is keep the vibration away from the natural frequency. Well, in this case, we really mechanically couldn't, you know, it was only attached to two ends. You couldn't really put anything in. So the way of trying to get around that was to reduce the flow of water, which was driving it, so to keep it away from that natural frequency. So what I'm trying to say is what got me into the world of where I was going is this whole flow-induced vibration problem and the sensors and what the sensors were telling you and what you were trying to do about it, okay?
Okay, so it is a long way around.
It is a long way home.
Again, no macros.
Right. No, there were neutrons involved. Were there neutrinos, though? I forget. I missed the neutrinos.
No, it was neutrons. Neutrons that are, you know, going too fast, so they can't react often enough, so you don't get energy out. You got to slow them down.
Yeah.
And then this is to measure the speed through the, you know, indirect measurement and so forth. Yeah. It's just, so the thing that is running through my mind as he's talking about this is, you know, this the song, I'm talking about bad vibrations. It's not good vibrations, they're bad vibrations. Right.
Oh.
This tube that has about an inch of play is boring a 52 square inch hole in the fuel bundle, you know, of the nuclear plant. You know, what's the side effect? You know, Fukushima. Uh-oh. So, you know, you talk about the S-bomb, you know, these indirect knock-on effects. Little teeny thing, and the unintended consequences. And then he talks about how, okay, this, he's trying to do this calculation for the, to get a number, maybe a couple of numbers. And these numbers feed the safety system design, and they feed the fuel consumption design, and the amount of time this thing is running. So at the end of the day, you know, they take a look, say, it's not moving too much. It should be fine. It turns out, no.
Well, this, again, what I love about OT, you know, I love about boats, right? You know, it's, you know, to the point we're sort of getting to here, right? You know, that there is, in fact, literally infinite, you know, information you can have, you know, to build a system with, but you can't get there, you know, because there's not literally infinite time. So what do you do? And last Saturday before last, you know, this boat I'm on sank. Because I had tied them up in a safe spot and anchored them up and went off to chair a conference on critical infrastructure cybersecurity for a couple of days in Nashville, Tennessee. And I made a mistake. You know, I, at the last minute, out of a fit of diligence, you know, I'd already secured the boats, but I threw in an extra anchor off the back. There wasn't any room, so it went straight down and it was low tide. And there's a 2-foot tide anyways, but the time I was gone, it went another foot or two higher. And the anchor served its purpose and held down the back of the boat, and the ocean rose over it, which is non-optimal, right? Yeah. But I and have two.
The boat didn't sink. The ocean rose.
But yeah, I sailed two boats side by side. They're both experimental solar-powered boats. So when I got back, one of them was fine. and had power and lights and battery and fresh water and so forth. So it gave me the time to dwell on the other one and do the various things to get it back on top of the ocean and be sitting here with you recording these things today in what was 3 feet of water. So we had to, you know, we actually can build nuclear power stations. You know, we can build things that are effectively, from an individual perspective, infinitely complex. You don't have time in your life to understand every single piece of it. How do we do that? You know, one step at a time, right? Compensating controls, specialization. There are someone out there who actually knows where the neutrons and the neutrinos are going, but you don't have to know.
Well, but somebody does.
Somebody does somewhere. Yeah, that's right.
Which brings us to airplanes, right? So the reason planes are safe is not because we ever knew everything we had to know, and we still don't know everything we need to know. What we know is it broke. We figured out why. It's not just we broke, it broke and we fixed it. Somebody spent the time, a bunch of people spent the time to figure out why it is. What was the reason for this? How do we eliminate that problem? And you eliminate more and more of the problems and you start to run out of problems. And this is one of the really interesting phenomena is it seems like it's finite. Yes, there's these infinitesimal one in every however many it's going to happen, but there is some level that you get to where in practice, it just never goes wrong anymore.
Right.
And now we talk about the information technology world for a moment. And in the IT world, we never get anywhere close to that. We don't even try. It's like, no, we're just going to go forward. We're never going to debug that thing ever.
Well, you know, ever's a long time, right? You know, I think.
Let's just talk about my recording of these sessions, which I had been doing in Google Chrome for the last, well, coming up on a 1 year for this show. So I've been doing it in Google Chrome for the last year for this show, along with doing all sorts of other things in Chrome, as opposed to Firefox. Firefox does it as well. That's what we're using today. And the reason we're using Firefox today is because Google Chrome did an update. And the update causes it to not be able to do what it used to be able to do. Now, I tried to revert, but of course, they designed it to not revert. So I uninstalled it and reinstalled it. Well, it turns out some of the stuff that was supposed to uninstall didn't completely uninstall. So when you reinstalled it, now it was confused. After so many crashes, I finally, you know, doing a bunch of backups and so forth, rebooted my system, and it seemed to work until it failed again. So now I have a second system that's sitting next to it. In my second system, I have old versions. I don't put new versions in that system at all. So I have a system from a couple of years ago, and so it still worked there for an event or two. So now I have a third system where I do the testing for these things. So I'm trying to test the other system to find out what went wrong and how to fix it and so on and so forth. Meanwhile, real-time events continue on. So this redundancy that we are afforded in not in airplanes, you know, we need a lot of redundancy in airplanes because otherwise we'll crash. And on boat, you need redundancy because the third thing kills you. Well, on my desk, I have redundant computers, redundant internet, redundant power, and I still suffer outages, but they're short and we're compensated for. I continue to the end of the meeting and the end of the day and then spend yet another night trying to undo whatever it is that some so-and-so did at Google or at wherever they did it. You know, because Google uses software from other places. It could be 17 steps down the line. Wherever that change happened, you know, I'm there fighting against it to get things working again by the next morning. And it occurred to me earlier this week that I just absolutely hate that. When am I going to get to the point where I don't have to just spend hour after hour after hour keeping fixing things so that my day-to-day stuff works all the time?
Well, and the answer, you know, is because, you know, my whole obsession with inevitability curves in my new show, starting on Textron, you know, on by that name, you know, I think there is an end to this curve, but I don't think I'm going to live to see it. I think this is just a bigger thing than we like to think, but I don't think cybernetics is infinitely complex the way it is today, right? I don't think a million years from now we're still going to have the same problems we have now. I think there is an end to it, but it's just a huge we talk exponentials and, you know, orders of magnitude all the time and so forth. But, you know, the marine environment, for example, we're used to gathering data to manage marine environments by eye, right? Or by writing it down. Or in the modern world, spending 18 months to put out one buoy that, you know, gets one set of data in one spot out of, you know, 100 million acres of stuff. And we're moving to a world where data in the marine environment will be real time and just so much more than you can possibly imagine, right? And every aspect of
so many more problems than you can possibly imagine.
Right. So so I don't think it's unsolvable, but I just don't think it's something we solve in a decade or two. It might be a century or two. It's not forever, but it might be a long, long time while we're still screwing around with the settings on our application because everything just changed in the last 5 years. Again, last 5 months, 5 days.
Yeah, 5 minutes. Well, in fact, there were just a couple of emergency updates to Apple's iPhone yet again for some other vulnerability they found. And, you know, we're going to get tired of these emergencies. At some point, maybe we're going to demand no more emergencies. Like there's going to be a punishment for emergencies. So instead of coming out with that new version right away and being highly competitive with whatever that feature is, there's something called the Snap file system in Linux that came out, I don't know how long ago, not that long ago, which I think is screwing everything up. And before that, when you installed whatever versions of Linux for a while, it automatically started without asking your permission to do a search of everything on your hard drive that you ever put in there and characterize it and make it all searchable, right? So you could very quickly search it, which consumed double the amount of disk space, right? Because you have to store all the search data. And for the first however many weeks or months that you're running the bloody thing after you've installed your 2 terabytes of data from your old system, the whole computer is spending all of its time just searching through that, keeping you from getting things done. And so learning how to disable, at some point they stopped doing that because they realized, I guess, enough people said, stop it. But this is the creeping featureism. I have a new feature. I'm going to put it in. It's going to be cool. Here's another one. The desktop that takes the entire screen. So everything takes the whole screen so you can't look at or do two things at once, right? And residuals from that linger indefinitely. I mean, we have it coming back. The audio technology that I use to do the edits of these shows, that technology in the newer version decided all of a sudden it would go full screen every time you opened a new file. You know, well, why did you do that? So I tracked it down. Somebody else had complained about it before, but the person who, you know, owns it, who's doing it, said, well, you should not never open it again. You should just be doing everything from inside it. It's like, well, I want you to use it my way, and I don't care to correct it if you do it somebody else's way. Okay.
I think this is very organic, right? You know, so, I mean, you know, I literally right here in the Biscayne Bay and the Florida Keys and so forth, brown algae. You know, brown algae is good. It makes a lot of oxygen, except there's too much of it because the nutrient balance is wrong. And the jellyfish are, you know, there's too many jellyfish, again, because the, you know, ecology's gone out of whack. And why? Because they can. You know, those brown algae, you know, individual little creatures out there are not saying, making a conscious decision about this. And, you know, they're just, it works. And this is what I love about, you know, honestly, capitalism for all its, you know, arguable flaws and so forth, and moderated capitalism where people can just try. If you can make a living doing something, you know, the nutrients are there, go ahead and do that, because apparently people want that. And even if it's largely entirely wrong, at least forevermore we'll have that one example where we go, oh, y'all remember that time we all bought the thing and it sucked? Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. We learned that one, right? And it ratchets forward. You know, because people like, you know, I mentioned this on one of our group calls just this week, right? You know, my whole inevitability curve thing. I think one of the things we forget is this enormous influence of people just not liking things, right? You can say, if we keep doing this forever, we're going to end up with all these problems. And whether it's, you know, climate ecology, sociology, whatnot, and we find out we never quite reach that point because a lot of, you know, it's just unpleasant, right? And in the cyberspace, we're all experiencing this together. This, yeah, everything you said, we all know it. And it's great generalized, you know, evolutionary forces that will encourage, you know, somebody who can fix those things. God help you, please do.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show. Mark makes a fail-safe right blocker fail. Safe. Block? Right? Hmm. Joe fights the water and the water wins. Well, doesn't it always? ELN and A2E start AI, G2A, and TTE in 2024. Clear as mud? More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.